to you if you've just arrived during tea break. And, well, welcome my tray bander. Funny saying welcome my tray bander, because my tray bander probably welcomed me the first time I came to the Buddha Centre. But welcome my tray bander. Really nice to have you here. And we're here, of course, this evening to launch your book, The Journey and the Guide, your latest book. And so the format of the evening is going to be I'm going to ask my tray bander some questions. We're going to be in conversation, my tray bander and I. Well, actually, he's probably going to talk the most. Prompted by me. And then at the end, there'll be time to buy the book if you so wish. And then if you'd like my tray bander to sign your book, he is very happy to sign some books at the end.
I've got a pen.
You've got a pen. Yeah. Good. 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 And there's a special discount. Actually, I was going to do a trick question for the beginner because of my tier maths. I was going to say, so if the book's usually £11.99 and we're selling it for £10. All right. So
I'm famous for bad maths.
Yeah. So
there's no maths in the book.
There's no maths in the book. So the first thing that struck me about this book, well, it's the title really, my tray bender. So you call the book The Journey and the Guide.
Mm.
So if you're taking us on a journey, where are we going?
I want to say immediately, I have no idea. Well, in a way, I don't have any idea where the journey leads, because we've got the figure of the enlightened Buddha, and I know that the journey leads to enlightenment. In fact, it even says practical course in enlightenment. But I don't know what enlightenment is, and nor do you. In fact, if you think about it more deeply, from one point of view, we really don't know what it is. Just because we've got a name for enlightenment, just because we've got the word Buddha and a figure, a golden figure, doesn't mean to say we know what it is. What's weird about that is that we sort of do as well. If we really didn't know what enlightenment was, and enlightenment is, I feel convinced, the very goal of human life. If we really didn't know what it was, in that literal sense, we literally wouldn't know which way to point. We wouldn't know what actions could lead us to it. We'd have no idea how to get to a goal if we really didn't know what it was. And yet, from one point of view, we really don't. We've just got words that suggest a goal. Even the word goal is problematic. So on one point of view, we don't know what enlightenment is. I don't know, having just written a book about it. And then on another hand, in a way, sort of more surprising still, is that we sort of do. And the sort of is very important. If there wasn't anything in us that didn't chime with the goal of enlightenment, we'd have no idea, we wouldn't be able to perceive it, even if it was there in front of us. We can only perceive something which we have within us, which we have that buried within us. It can be buried very deep indeed. But we sort of do know what enlightenment is. Even when we look at this image, we sort of know what it's getting at. When you go on retreats, and when you go deeper in your meditation on retreats or in communication on retreats, you have a sense that life is leading somewhere. I have a sense that life is leading something, that life has within it an intrinsic direction. It's not a direction given by Buddhism. It's not a Buddhist direction. But life has within it intrinsically a kind of structure, a kind of direction. And that direction that you can feel directly in your meditation, in a communication that goes more deeply, in artistic pursuits, in your experience of nature. You can feel in our best moments that life is going somewhere, that it adds up to something, that it's more than just getting through stuff. And that the goal, and to have a direction, there must be a goal. There can be no concept of a direction, felt feeling of a direction, without that direction going somewhere. So the Buddha represents, enlightenment represents that goal. And we, as soon as we have a sense of direction in our life, Do you know that time when you sometimes it's when you first come to the Buddhist centre, you feel, gosh, this is what I'm doing. This is something to do with the direction of my life, which feels both intimately personal and universal. As soon as you have a sense of a direction in your life, you have the Buddha. You have enlightenment, because for a direction there needs to be a goal. But probably the best way to start is I have no idea where the journey leads.
And it's interesting that even within what you've said just now, you talked about there's also a problem of talking in terms of a goal,
which you do
address in the book as well. Do you want to say a little more about that?
Well, goals are fair enough. Nothing wrong with goals. In fact, I don't think that you could travel the path towards enlightenment without a sense of a goal. Sometimes people would like to get rid of them, but you can't really. As soon as you come to this centre, even if you've just come tonight, you've got some kind of goal in mind. Otherwise, you could be going to see Mission Impossible. And you'd even have a goal in mind going to see that. Presumably, you'd want to enjoy it. That would be your goal. So you can't help but have goals. I think as you practice, your sense of a goal needs to get more and more metaphoric. My experience is that when I first got involved, I came along to this centre when I was 25, 30 years ago or something, nearly 30 years ago. And, I had a very, as soon as I was taught to meditate, I knew I was a Buddhist. Yeah. I knew I always had been a Buddhist and I knew I always would be. And I remember thinking, it all felt very straightforward. There was me, there was a path, and there was a goal. I remember, for instance, thinking, about 3 years and I'll be celibate. it's called naivety. So you start off inevitably with naive senses of the goal, just as somebody who starts to paint would start off with a naive sense of how long it's going to take to get them to do a really worthwhile picture, and how difficult it's going to be, and what the task really is. So I think as you go along the path, your sense of the goal changes. And it stops, in a sense, being a goal. Although it gets so metaphoric, it's difficult to talk about. But I don't tend to think of it as a goal. I don't think you can have a goal that you don't understand. It's easy to have a goal, I think goals are basically worldly. I think as soon as you come to this centre and you take your shoes off to come into this room, you're taking off your worldly sense of trying to get anywhere in the literal goal-orientated achievement, success kind of way. Valuable though, I'm not trying to sort of discredit them, but when you take your shoes off to come in here tonight, you're taking that off and you're exploring life and going deeper into life rather than trying to achieve a goal, which is usually taken in a very literal and narrow kind of way, I'd say.
And today, I was looking at the little video that you sent round today as part of the urban retreat. Many of you who are signed up for the urban retreat will have received a little teaching, little words from Maitreya Benda. And it was, you talked about that you have to think that there's a problem.
And it's with life.
With life, yeah.
Well, you don't have to think there is. You have to. There really is one, isn't there? I mean, in a way, I think any genuine deepening of life starts with a problem. The German philosopher Karl Popper thought that human beings are problem-solving animals, which I was very struck by. He thought all human activity is problem-solving. He even thought that art is problem-solving, and that was my experience of it, or at least trying to solve it. You have to. And I think the Buddha is teaching us in exactly the same way. He talked about the problem of suffering. I think that our life is intrinsically a problem. And I don't think Buddhism says that. I don't think you need to come here to find out. Just the very facts of your life is problematic. So first of all, the thing that occurred to me a while ago is that you're born. You know, that seems perfectly straightforward. You didn't choose to be born. You didn't choose who your parents were, and yet here you are, you just appear in life. a mixture of your parents, of all these, you know, tendencies and things that you need to discover. It's like you don't even have the manual to yourself. So you need, often clumsily and incoherently, to discover the kind of creature you are and how you work most effectively in life. And nobody can really help you with that. They can to a degree, but you're unique. So you can never, you're like everybody else, but in this weird way, you're not. So that's problematic. Being born, you know, parents that may or may not be very good at being parents, you know, and so on, that's a problem. But probably the greatest problem is that you're going to die. Not probably, that is the greatest problem. You are definitely going to die. I'm definitely going to die. And just to make matters worse, we have no idea when. I mean, we couldn't be in a more problematic situation. I mean, good way. The one thing we definitely know we don't want to happen will happen, and we've no idea when. I mean, how big a problem do you want to have? You know, any real life, any real human life, is confronting that problem. That the one thing you don't want to happen will happen, and you've no idea when. And what does that say about living now? In a way, that's what I've tried to address in the book.
And in the book, you begin the book by talking about life as a journey, don't you? We're walking along a muddy path with these ravines on either side.
The
ravines are traditionally nihilism and eternalism, but you've glossed them as secularism on one side and religion on the other side.
Mm.
So I was interested in that, especially because, well, we're Buddhists and this is a Buddhist centre, and I wanted to ask you, so do you think Buddhism isn't a religion then, would you say?
I'm starting to think it is a religion.
Okay.
And that's just me at the moment. Yeah. Tomorrow I'll probably be thinking it isn't.
Yeah.
Depends what mood I am in, depends who's asking me.
Yeah.
But at the moment I'm in a religious mood. And I'm in a religious mood because I'm particularly aware of trends, both in Buddhism and in general life, to turn Buddhism, or to reduce Buddhism into a well-being program, into an adjustment exercise, as if we could think that what a Buddhist is someone who works out intelligently how to adjust to everyday life. There's an aspect of Buddhism that's like that. But it doesn't do justice to Buddhism. So at the moment, I'm in a religious mood.
Mm.
I don't know whether I look like I am, but I am in a religious mood. Because I think the metaphor of religion suggests something profound, mystical, beyond your everyday consciousness, something that you can't understand with your everyday consciousness, that involves ritual, that involves story, that involves deep mythic patterns that you have to discover. And of course, as soon as I say that, I want to think, actually, it's not a religion. Because, I persuade myself it is one, only to think, no, it isn't, that's ridiculous. It's not a religion. Usually religions assume that you have to believe something. Usually you have to believe some supernatural force or deity, which I've always found just daft, frankly. I remember when I was a child, I was very involved in the Church of England. I used to sing in the choir 3 times a week. And I remember never believing in God. And I even remember trying. I went to see Godspell. I don't know whether it was. And for about a week, I managed to believe in Jesus. God was always a bit tricky, but I managed Jesus for about a week, and then even that collapsed. I don't think I have the sort of belief gene. I just thought it was daft, right, from a child. I thought it was a story we'd made up. So I think really that the Dharma is just something else. I'd rather just leave it as just something else. It's not a religion in the way we normally imagine it, in the sense of something you believe, something where there's usually a God figure that will judge you and so on. But neither is it secular. I'm at the moment a bit more concerned about the secularization of Buddhism. Even in some quarters, people have been talking about secular Buddhism, as if you could talk about, I don't know, secular Islam or secular Catholicism. So at the moment, I'm more concerned about that danger. So it's more, in my introduction, I say it's more like we're walking down this narrow path. And on one side, we've got religion, with all the confusions and quite often negativity that goes with that. Although not just that, because it's religion has also created an incredible wealth for human beings. It's been just a mixed blessing. And then on the left, you've got this sort of ravine that goes down to secularism, which is really a kind of narrow-minded rationalism, a belief that ordinary everyday consciousness, describing ordinary everyday consciousness, working with that, is the task of human life, which is, I just think, is paltry and small. And I would never have carried on practicing the Dharma had I just thought it was that. It's not big enough for me. I wouldn't be very good at secular Buddhism because it would be too cleaned up for me. So I think it's more, actually, I think I've overdone it in the book. I think it's actually, I think, as I am wont to do, I think it's just like a little trench either side of this path. And we fall in one and then muddily have to climb up again and then we fall in the other. And we're trying to sort of stay in the middle. And usually what we need along that path is friends who are also going along that path, who can pull us out of whichever particular trench we've fallen into, a sort of mumbo-jumbo-y, religious-y, Buddhist-y, you know, thing which gets a bit fanciful, or a kind of over-rationalistic, slightly superior idea that we're just trying to sort of manage everyday life, which I think is just not good enough. Not good enough for me and not good enough for us, I think, really.
And it sounds like, well, that's the you're suggesting that that's what we tend to do, is veer from one to the other.
Well, it's not really me that's suggesting it, it's the Buddha.
Okay.
He was a much wiser guy. But yeah, I mean, that's my translation of him saying that you've got eternalism on one hand, some idea of eternal verities, of heaven, hell and so forth, of God, and then you've got nihilism on another, of at the end when you die, nothing. I mean, that's the great problem of death again, is do we carry on in some form or do we stop? Our current fashion, and it is a fashion, at least here, not very far away, the fashion is swinging massively to religion again. I mean, when you start to think about the issues in the world, religion is suddenly, you know, God is coming back and he's in a really bad mood. You know what I mean? He's really cross with us for having killed him. He's coming back with a vengeance. So it really depends where you say these things. You know what I mean? And it's partly with those things in mind that people even try and talk about secular Buddhism and so on. I just think it's a foolish way of trying to talk about it. What was I saying? I can't remember where I was. I'm ranting about something.
That's all right. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll take you onto a new tangent.
Yeah, you better.
I've lost
my path.
That's all right. So one of the things that makes this book really unusual and unlike, well, not only your own Dharma books you've written, but anyone's that I've read, is that it's full of poetry. Like after every chapter, there's a poem, and there's not just the poem itself, there's your exploration of the poem. So why did you include so much poetry in the book?
Well, there's only eight. Actually, there's nine, but that's another matter. Well, I like poetry. it's a simple answer. That's not really the answer. Well, what I wanted to do in the book is it's a book on the five stages of spiritual life, which I think are the five stages of anyone's life who genuinely wants to make the most of their life. That's how I'd like to talk about the Dharma more. I think the real question, given that we're going to die and we don't know when that is how do we make the most of our life? That's the question that we need to be waking up with every morning and checking every night. How do we make the most of our life? It goes so quickly, doesn't it? So that's what I'd like to think about the book. And I think these five stages represent how we make the most of our life. And one of the elements of that, one of the stages, or really aspects, because you can think of these five stages as stages of a path or aspects of a mandala, a kind of pattern of our life. Sometimes we need to use the metaphor of a path, that our life is going somewhere, a direction to a goal. And sometimes we need to use the metaphor of our life just opening up, like a flower opens up with different aspects, and we're trying to perfect, not very good word, it's a Christian word, but trying to perfect each aspect. So what one of the stages is receptivity. And a little bit like my first book I wrote on friendship, and I didn't want to write a textbook on friendship. It would have seemed awful, and I don't think I could have done it. I wanted the book to feel like you were talking to a friend. I wanted the form and the content to coalesce. So when I wrote about spiritual receptivity, I didn't want to just write I didn't want to write two chapters on receptivity and explain what it was. What I wanted people to experience was to experience receptivity. And the obvious place, I mean, I would have liked to be able to have, I would like to have a painting in one that you looked at, a piece of music, you know. It's just a poetry prints, you know. So one of the things that poetry does, if you read it well, is you have to be receptive to read it. You can't read poetry like prose. You can't read it like journalism. We're used, aren't we, to reading quickly for information, to scan reading. Poetry wants, really, in front of every poem is a sign that says slow down. It's a slow down form. And the main reason you can tell it's a poem is because there's lots of white space around it, isn't it? I was doing this at a workshop recently. I held up this poem and I said, what's the first thing that strikes you? And someone said, it's in five stanzas. Someone else said, you know, it's got a title. I said, no, the first thing that strikes you is that the words don't go to the edge. It's as simple as that. The first thing about poetry is there's lots of white space around it. I think that white space is basically silence. So poetry is trying to, the wager of poetry is, what can I say in silence? What does silence want me to say? So there's silence before the poem, there's silence all around the poem, and there's silence after the poem. I think that's probably why poetry comes from religion, it comes from prayer. It also comes, interestingly, from nursery rhyme, doesn't it? That's where we've heard the most poetry, is in nursery rhyme. Children really love rhyme. They like the sounds of it. But it's speaking into silence, and therefore what's worth speaking into silence? So it's trying to, by that silence, say, this is important, and this is important enough for you to slow right down. It's important enough for you to savour it more. It's important enough for you to read it again and again, as you might do a prayer, or as your mother would have told you a nursery rhyme again and again. It's no good telling a nursery rhyme once. You want to sing it and so on. I had to tell you recently about when Alex, one of my so-called nieces, was about three, I remember singing Frère Jacques to her. And she obviously didn't have any French, and actually nor do I. But I can sing Frère Jacques. And I sang Frère Jacques to her, and she just suddenly stopped moving around and just stared fixedly at me. You know, her blue eyes seeming to get bluer and bluer. And she was like looking at me as if looking at the face of God almost. And then I finished. There's this pause. And she said, again. And so I'm Frère Jacques, Frère. And then she's completely listening to me again. And it stopped again. All that she knew is that there's this pattern. There's this structuring that's pleasing. I don't know what it is, I don't even understand the word, but again. So, you know, poetry comes from that childlike wonder, and it comes from prayer. And both of those things are about just being receptive. When I sang Frère Jacques to Alex, she didn't think, yeah, but hang on, what is it saying? It's just a moment of pure receptivity. Do you see what I mean? So why I've included the poems in the book is that I wanted to change the tone of the book so that you had to change your mode and be more receptive. Actually, there are lots of different tones in the book. I'm writing different styles in the book. I think it is the most unusual Dharma book, well, that I've seen anyway.
And that connects with something else I was going to ask you. The book's very practical, isn't it? There's lots of suggestions for exercises and practices that one can do. And one that kind of recurs throughout the book is practice, if you can call it that, of doing nothing. So I wanted to ask you, one, why you suggest that, but also your I know that's a practice that's become more important to you, if you'd say more about that in your own life.
I'm not doing much of nothing at the moment, I'm afraid, but anyway, I have been doing quite a bit of nothing at times. Well, I mean, I was very struck by Cinemass's announcement about consumerism. It's interesting, one of the things I've just been writing, actually, just today, about consumerism is that we complain about it, but it suits us. It actually, the reason it works is because we actually kind of want to be distracted. It's not that consumerism is forcing distraction on us, and not otherwise we would be contemplating the facts of life and meditating all the time. If it was like that, it'd be easy, wouldn't it? Actually, we rather want to be distracted. We don't consciously want to be, but we connive with the mass media, we connive with consumerism, because we feel uncomfortable. We feel uncomfortable in ourselves, and we feel that something's wrong about life. Somewhere, right, I think, right at the back of our mind, we know that we're going to grow old, become sick and die. And that makes us feel uncomfortable. So we'd rather not stop too long. We want to just do something, download something. We connive with consumerism. I think we should be very careful about criticising it, because we're part of it. We're not innocent bystanders, in the drama of consumerism, however destructive it is, and it is hugely destructive. We want it, otherwise it wouldn't work. We want it often in a sort of subconscious way. Mentally we can be, you know, give talks about how terrible it is. But I just recently bought two books. Anyway, scandal. So probably one thing we can do, and perhaps one of the radical things we can do now, is do nothing at all. It's never been easier to waste time. I don't know whether you find this, but I remember the first time I bought a book whilst on a train, just by flexing my thumb, because it said, on my Kindle, it said, you might be interested in this book. I'm interested in that book. How do they know me so well? And then I thought, well, I'm not going to buy it. And then it said, you can just download, you know, the start of it for free. I thought, well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's like going into a bookshop, you know. So, you know, thumb, download it for free. And then I read it, that was really good. Do you want to buy it now? I bought it. But I'd never... It seemed to, for me, a historical moment that I could buy a book, whilst travelling on a train. I've never done that before. So now, you don't have to go anywhere. All you need to do is flex your thumb. Eventually, you won't need to even do that. So probably one of the most radical things, one of the most countercultural things we can do just now, is do nothing at all. But doing nothing at all, and I mean what I've been doing in my room upstairs is lighting my shrine. I get a cup of tea, and then I sit there, and I try and just keep sitting there and resist the urge to do anything. You have to turn everything off, otherwise you get bing, bing, as your computer reminds you of nice possible things coming in your email. And I resist, and what you have to do is you have to go kind of through a boredom threshold. Nowadays, what consumerism is telling us is you need never feel bored again. So as soon as you start to feel bored, you can bounce off that into buying something, downloading something, looking at something. And all that does is it just keeps us superficial. Boredom is a kind of intermediate state between ordinary consciousness and a deeper consciousness. But usually it's too uncomfortable to go through. So instead of feeling that boredom and letting you go through, it's a kind of threshold consciousness boredom. Instead of going through the threshold into a deeper consciousness, often that's what happens in meditation as well, into a new consciousness. We just bounce off boredom into doing something. So particularly on retreats, but also at home, I've been trying to do more of nothing. And for me, that particularly means not reading, because I actually think if you can't do nothing, the least you can do is read. I start to feel that turning and actually opening a book and reading a book is now getting as difficult in modern life as sitting down and closing your eyes to meditate. It takes as much willpower, because the computer is our doorway to everything, isn't it? If you've been working on a computer all day, and what do you do in the evening? To relax, you watch a DVD, or you, still worse, flick through your Facebook feed, or, you know. I think now turning the computer off is one of the most difficult moments of our life. You know, Like the other day, I decided not to work on my computer in the daytime on a Sunday. Normally, I fiddle with poems. It's my sort of, as a confession, it's a sort of obsessive activity. So what I did is I decided not to do that, and I just read a novel all day. And I'd really forgotten what it's like to spend a Sunday reading a novel. I so enjoyed it. I don't think I've done it since I was really quite young, even. Not for a whole day, just read a novel. And not in this case, it wasn't a novel I needed to read. I wasn't reviewing it. There was nothing in it for me apart from the pleasure of the novel. So if you can't do nothing, at least read something and turn everything off. But then, you know, see if you can, at the end of reading something, see if you can just do nothing at all. Just look out the window. And what I, as I say, experience is this sort of boredom. And you have this sort of, you remember things. That's what I notice. You just relax. Oh, it's nice to do nothing. Oh, my God, I need to do that. And sometimes what I'll do is write myself a note to remind myself. But gradually, you go through all that turbulence and a new kind of consciousness can start to arise, really simply, just by sitting in a chair and doing nothing. Try it out. Try it with your friends. Actually, you can't try it with your friends, but try it out.
That might or might not tie in with the next thing I was going to ask you. I was rereading your book, and one sort of part of a sentence just really leapt out at me, and I wanted, excited me, and I wanted to ask you what it meant. So you wrote, "Self is too small for life."
Oh, yes, yeah.
Sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, that's quite straightforward. it is, isn't it? I don't know, it might be just my age, but I'm getting thoroughly fed up with myself. I don't mean that in that kind of self-hating kind of way, although, you know, I've had my history of that. But self, what's the big deal about it? It's not actually that much. It feels like self is just like a tin with a few sweets in and the odd coin and a bit of fluff, you know. and a key that you've got and you can't remember what it's for. A photograph or something. little kissy heart, one of those. And then, little kind of inspiring, little jingly thing. And what we seem to so easily do is just spend our lives, you know, kind of turning over. Oh, there's me in a good mood, there's me in a bad mood, there's me feeling rather spiritual, there's me wanting, you know, a donut, you know. Actually, by the time you're 54, you've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, over and over and over again. And that includes, you know, well, not your best moments perhaps, but it includes the better moments, the greater moments. You've experienced them before. They're still inside this kind of little tin of you. I find it, Chris, it's just too small for life. I want, and I think we all want, the whole of life. I mean, human beings couldn't be more ambitious, couldn't be more crazy in a certain sort of sense, that we want the whole of life. We're not just satisfied with reiterating ourselves. Larkin, in the end of his life, he went round and reading his poems, and he said that he felt that he had finally learnt to do a good impersonation of himself. Getting up. Do you feel that sometimes, particularly in social situations, that you're just kind of doing an impersonation of your life? I was interviewed just the other day by someone, and I was so bored by what I was saying. I hope you're not bored by what I was saying. But I just thought, I've already thought this. I mean, it was fine. I mean, it was marvellous, I'm sure. absolutely marvellous. People will say, that was so wise, and it seems so off the cuff. I'm sure it was marvellous, but I've thought it before, and as soon as I've thought something before, it's a bit tedious to repeat it. I mean, I'll repeat it if other people need it. But what I'm interested in is the ground beyond me. I think that's... I got involved in the Dharma through the arts. I was a painter when I first came. Oh, a painter. I actually went to art school, which meant occasionally painting. We did a lot of looking out of the window and smoking dope. But, I came through the arts, and... an artist, and this is what I discovered even in that time, that a real artist is always interested in the ground they haven't covered. They're not, any real artist isn't just trying to reiterate what they've done. Like Larkin is a wonderful example of a real artist. You know, he'll write a poem in which he uses a particular word and never use that word again. One of the reasons there's so few poems in Larkin's output is that he never wanted to repeat himself. Incredibly strict in that sort of way. Any real artist is always looking for the ground beyond you. And I think that's the same thing as spiritual life, this dreadful word spiritual, which is really just a deepening of human life, is anyone who is serious about life is always trying to look for the ground beyond them, which is the ground beyond yourself. We human beings are ambitious creatures. We want the whole of life. We want life to be continually expanding. So, you know, just recently I went a walk with my good friend Vididaka, and I said, I've got a thought. I want to tell you my thought. I was very pleased with it. Even Cinemanus thought it was a thought. So I decided, because they're very rare thoughts. People say they have thoughts, but they're quite rare creatures. And I told Vididaka my thoughts. And partly I was hoping by telling him my thought, because I think out loud, I might go further with my thought, you know. That's what we're all trying to do, isn't it? We don't want to just live us. So I think that self is too small for life. I think the Buddha represents someone who's continually, perpetually, living in the ground beyond themselves. Except for the Buddha, there isn't a ground that they're leaving. It becomes utterly mysterious. You can't even say that the Buddha is sort of going beyond himself, because the Buddha doesn't have a self which he's going beyond. But Buddhahood is a continual unfolding of consciousness, a continual kind of play. And we have a sense, anyway, it comes back to your first question, we have a sense in our best moments of consciousness arising in new ways, of us reinventing ourselves moment to moment, and of that being an endlessly creative process. The Buddha represents that being completely lived. That, I think, is really worth devoting my life to. I don't know, whether is that a religion or is it secular? I have no idea. It goes beyond that kind of binary, that kind of literalism. But it's really worth devoting your life to. I think that's the sort of thing I meant by self is too small for life.
Great, thank you. And with the book, how would you like people to use the book? Oh, that's not a very good word. What's your hope for?
Well, I'd like them to buy it for a start. All the money, all the, what is it called?
Proceeds?
No.
What money?
What does the author get? Royalties, thank you. They all go to the LBC, so it'll help the LBC if you buy the book. None of it gets to me, folks. So I'd like you to buy it and buy your friend. Surprise, surprise. Having just talked about consumerism. Isn't it terrible? Isn't it terrible? If you buy my book, that's different. But it's terrible, isn't it? Anyway, I'd like to buy it. I mean, the first thing I always want to say is you can just read it. I mean, it is actually more than that, I hope. But you can just read it, because that's what we normally do with books. And what I'd like is that you enjoy it. I've written it, I've tried to write it, so you enjoy it as a read, as a literary experience, as a read. Literary is a posh word for just enjoy it. If you don't enjoy reading it, I've not worked hard enough on it. So I'd like you to enjoy it. The ideal would be to get the book, read it, and do it as an 8-week course. I've written it as an 8-week course book, and I will be leading the course here at the RBC in October. So the ideal would be to read it and do the course. So the ideal would be to read the book and put it into practice. That's my concept of the book. The difference with Life with Full Attention, which is quite kind of the sequel to, that's a bit trivial, but it's... I'm trying to go further than Life of Full Attention. The idea of it is that, the difference of that is that, yes, it is practical, but in this book there's more to think about. I'm trying to ask you to think about more profound matters and try to put that into effect in your life. So it's more ambitious as a book, I think, than Life of Full Attention, although, Life of Full Attention arrives there at the end. The journey and the guide starts there. It starts with old age, sickness and death. It starts with the Buddha and trying to follow his footsteps. And it's then saying, okay, let's try and follow the Buddha's footsteps for the next 8 weeks. It's quite a lot to do in 8 weeks, so you might want to... I mean, another way of doing it, and quite a few people have been doing this, is doing the, like with Life Full Attention, is doing it with a small group of friends. I even suggest this might be a way you do it, where you just get a group of friends together. You all read the book together over a whatever period of time, 16 weeks, whatever it wanted to be. You read it together and you all report in about how you're getting on with putting it into practice. But at the same time, so I want to stress all that, but I also want to say you can't just read it. I hope reading it will be enjoyable and valuable. But my ideal for the book is that you put it into practice.
And it's in, well, as you said, it's in the journey is in these five stages. Yes. Do you want to just give us a wee tour?
Sort of tour of the stages.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the book starts with the Buddha seeing what's called the four sights. So it's firstly old age, sickness and death. And what struck me about those three sights was how come we see those things all the time. We see them in the street around us, in our families. We see it in our mirror as we age. But why doesn't it change our life? Why doesn't it alter us altogether? Why don't we really take it in at all, hardly? And one of the reasons why is we're not integrated enough. One of the reasons. So the first great stage of spiritual life is taking full ownership of our life. Very often our thoughts and our emotions go off in different directions. We, you know, feel one thing and we think another. We aren't one person, we're a collection of persons. And we can never go anywhere as a collection, often in conflict with ourselves. So the first thing to do is become a healthy human being, an integrated person who takes ownership of their life, particularly the effect they have in their life. And then the second great stage is to become what I've called rather clumsily and what Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement, calls positive emotion. The trouble with that is it sounds a bit too chirpy and a bit too emotional, but I explain all that in the book. But basically we need to then make a contribution to life. It's not enough just to be integrated and whole and, you know, very complete in ourselves and the calm and pleasure that evokes. You experience it particularly in meditation. We need also to make a contribution to life, to our life and to the lives of all those we see around us. You know, things like giving and so on, generosity particularly is so important. So that's the second great stage. And then after we've become integrated and positively, emotionally positive, we need to die. We need to spiritually die. We need to realise that self isn't big enough for life. We need to realise that however refined our consciousness is, however developed we are, self is always just this little tin with a few buttons in it, with the one or two coins that we rattle around, you know, our voice is the rattling of a few coins. And we've got to let that go. For the whole of life to dawn upon us, we've got to let that go. And that can just mean letting go of our reactivity, our lack of receptivity, our terrible opinionatedness, our knowing so much. For many of us, and I include myself, we'd be much better off not knowing very much, admitting our lack of knowledge. We need to die to our sort of self-infatuation, really, our obsession with ourselves. That needs to die, and then when that dies, a wholly new kind of consciousness is reborn. And that's what's figured by the Buddha figure behind us. A new consciousness is reborn, which I've tried to talk about, but it's very, very difficult to talk about, because it's not a consciousness gathered around a sense of I and me and mine. It's a new kind of consciousness that arises in which self and world are no longer in antagonism. Me and you are no longer antagonistic. It's a new kind of consciousness. Just as we have a new consciousness now than we did as a child, and that a child can't imagine an adult consciousness. Similarly, we can't imagine the consciousness of a Buddha. It's a new kind of consciousness. But it's part of us. Just as an adult consciousness is there, the beginnings of it is there in a child, and if they grow up, it will start to manifest, although even adult consciousness is fairly rare, even in us so-called adults. I think many of us never get beyond 8. The consciousness of a Buddha is linked to us in the same way. It's not separate from us, but it, at the moment, is unimaginable. And then to be open to that, we need to be receptive. That's the other stage of the spiritual life, isn't it? We need to be constantly practicing this receptivity. So those are the 5 stages or the 5 aspects. And I don't want to say spiritual life, I just want to say human life. To get anywhere in life, you need to be integrated. To feel like life has been worth living, you need to be positively, emotionally positive. You need to make a contribution. When you die, I bet you nobody cares about your successes, whatever they were. What they'll care about is your human qualities, your kindness, your generosity, your willingness to put yourself out for your friends, your thoughtfulness. What we're bothered about in human beings is their humanness, and that is a value. At the very least, those 2 great stages are absolutely central to his human life. Without them, you won't feel that you've done much, however successful, impressive you've been. Without those 2 stages, you'll feel at death that you haven't done very much. But a Buddhist wants to go further than that. They're not content with that. They're more ambitious. They want the whole of life. And of course, I believe that we all do, really. Yeah.
Did you have a favourite section of the book when you were writing it?
No, they were all a bit difficult. So I thought, right, then here we go, integration. I know all about integration. And as soon as I said, what is integration? You know, as soon as you start to think about these issues more deeply, I found them much more difficult. I think probably I enjoyed most the writing the chapters on spiritual rebirth, because and spiritual death, because I was trying to write about things that I'd never tried to write about before. And I found that difficult to write, but also it stretched me in this way of going beyond myself. I think at times I was writing more than I could, and that is very satisfying. But also, that's what I'm trying to do with my life. So probably those chapters on spiritual death and rebirth are the ones that I think I was most engaged in.
I felt particularly engaged in the spiritual rebirth, and you talked about, you've used imagination a lot, haven't you? Imagination. And you've said, well, maybe you can tell us a bit about how you see imagination, what it is and what it isn't, which you've gone into.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I've talked about it a lot in the book, but the 2 chapters on spiritual rebirth basically are focusing on imagination. Our great gift as human beings is that we can imagine. Even as you're listening to me now, you're imagining me. You're not just listening to the content of the words, you're imagining me, you're tuning into me to some degree. And to the degree to which you're imagining me, this will be worthwhile for you. To the degree to which you aren't, it won't feel worthwhile to me. To the degree you feel you get me, the more I'll feel valuable to you. The degree to which I feel that I'm really communicating to you and trying to talk to you seriously in the best sense, something will arise, yeah? And that's an imaginative thing. It's not just to do with the information that I'm saying or you're saying. So our great gift is that we can imagine. We can imagine new states of consciousness. That's what this figure represents, is the imagination of a new state of consciousness. And imagination always takes us beyond ourselves. You know, obviously I've used the analogy of artists a lot because that's my background. I would have liked to use science more, but that involved maths, I believe, and I'd better leave off. Jan of Arch is the man who can talk about science. I would like to have talked about it more. It's not something I can write about. But, you know, any artist knows, any poet that sits down to write a poem knows that the poem is not written by the person who sits down with a mug of tea at their laptop. What they're always hoping is that imagination takes flight and takes them beyond what they can do. And that beyond is not chaotically beyond, but the beyond that you achieve when imagination lights up is a deeper perception of life, a more whole perception, a more integral perception, The artist creates a work of art to find out what they really think, to find out what they really feel, and that their ordinary consciousness can't do that. Sometimes when you write a poem or paint a picture, you discover, gosh, that's what I really mean. You discover a seriousness that you didn't think you had. You discover an emotional pliancy and nuance that you didn't think you had. You discover more when your imagination is lit up. One of the primary things we need to do in our life is light up our imagination, discover our imagination. We've all got it, and make it more alive. You know, so I was using the example of Van Gogh painting his boots, his old work boots. And, you know, we've all looked at boots, but I bet we haven't looked at them with that degree of accuracy, with that degree of feeling, with that degree of poignancy, with that degree of concentration on the bootness of those boots. They aren't boots. They're those particular boots at that particular moment that, as he painted them, they become the world, you know, because they're never-repeated boots, just like every moment of life is a never-repeated moment, which becomes so easily a banality, even a kind of Buddhist cliché. But the artist is trying to give it so much of their attention that they become an object of the imagination. And by doing that, become much more than themselves, which they already are. So the main thing we're trying to do is discover our imagination. We can see, just like Van Gogh can see, but I bet we don't see as deeply as Van Gogh. We can hear, like a musician can hear, but I bet we don't hear with such emotional resonance. We can think, like a philosopher can think, but I bet we don't think as deeply. All of these actions of the imagination. And that's really what this clumsy word Buddhism is trying to guide you into, help you discover, and help you take it, be taken by it, beyond your imagination, which is where the Buddha sits.
Great. Good. Well, maybe that's a good note to wind up, yeah? Unless you had anything else.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, good. That's thank you very, very much. I really enjoyed what we talked to each other all the time.
Yeah, we do, yeah. We're always talking to not in front of such a large
crowd. But really just want to thank you. Well, for writing the book, but also, just for coming along and talking to us, because anyway, I think it does bring it more alive. And I've really, even on the first couple of readings, really loved reading this and felt like I've learned a lot. And it has, it's excited me and inspired me, actually. So very, very much to recommend the book. It's a special price of £10 tonight. It's usually £11.99. And really, really recommend that you come on the course. The course is already booking up. This is a course. The 8-week course starts on the Wednesday, the 14th of October. So if you want to be guided through this book by Maitreya Bandhu, I'd more than recommend signing up for that course as well. So books on sale outside. Maitreya Bandhu is more than willing to sign copies of the book. You'll be on the sofa. Thank you, Maitreya Bandhu, and I thank everyone. But let's thank Maitreya.